Hello, and welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, Chief Investment Officer. Baskin Wealth Management is an independently owned investment management firm with over $2 billion in assets under management, providing customized wealth management solutions and services to families and foundations. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations that make sense about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. All right, we're back on the podcast with Ernest Wong. Last week, we did a financial planning edition with our colleague Benjamin Klein, and we plan to do a lot more of the financial planning. Ernest, what's your thoughts on financial planning?
Well, I think we often talk about the investing with me and you.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that you have to keep in mind is that the investing depends on your objective, which is the financial planning, mm-hmm. right? Like, just because one stock or one specific investment product works for one person doesn't mean it works for another person.
Yeah.
And that's where financial planners come in.
I view investing like investing is the journey, right? And so, but how do you know where, what destination you want to go to until you do a financial plan? And one of the things that's really, I find really interesting, and Benjamin brought that up in our last podcast, is you really find out your risk tolerance through investing and through ups and down markets, especially, in 2022 or the financial crisis or during COVID, whatever the examples are. Those that thought they could handle the rougher journey can't. And so obviously creating the financial plan and not rocking the boat too much with your portfolio over the long term hopefully can get you to where you want to go.
Yeah, and I think that in a perfect world, you would just own the stocks that you want to own and you just hold them forever.
Yeah.
But people have things that they want to do. They want to buy houses for their kids. They want to go on vacations. They want to retire, right?
They need money to live off of, to eat. Yeah. So, I mean, that and those change things, of course, with your portfolios. But it's our job for our clients to pick good investments to set the table. And so we'll talk about a few of those things here today. Ernest, we are, everybody loves to talk bull market, bear market. Obviously, in a bull market, stocks go up. Not every stock goes up, but stocks go up. And I always find it surprising that people say, oh my God, stocks are so expensive or stocks doing well. What should I do? Well, I mean, that's what happens in a bull market. It's harder to find cheaper investments. As they say, the rising tide lifts all ships.
No, I think that's something to keep in mind when You often hear people say, oh, should we be trimming this stock or that stock because it's getting expensive? Mm-hmm. But what are you going to buy? Like, if the whole market's up, like everything is kind of by definition expensive.
Yes.
So like if you just sell one stock to buy another stock, then you have to pay taxes and you're probably not in a better place in the end.
We're in a weird position right now for a lot of clients, not necessarily every new client, but clients that have been here a long time where pretty much every stock is in a taxable account is sitting in capital gains. And so we now have to be careful about how we take gain. Not to say that we are not adverse to taking gains or trimming stuff or making moves, but there's not a lot to offset the gains that we're taking. And hopefully that continues. I mean, I don't want capital losses for capital loss sake, but that's what happens when you are owning good compounding companies over the long term.
And I think a distinction has to be made between a company that is maybe a little overstretched in the near term mm-hmm. and a ridiculous valuation that you're going to lose money on, right? So if you own a good business that is going to grow earnings by double-digit rates every year, even if you're paying a fairly high multiple going in, it'll probably work out in the end because the earnings are growing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're weed stocks, for example, if you're buying totally unprofitable garbage,
yeah,
thinking that it's going to be the next big thing, there's nothing to support it, right? That can go to zero.
Especially after that bubble has burst in that euphoria, right?
Yep. And so I think that's a distinction that needs to be made.
So let's talk about Warren Buffett. And he released his shareholder letter. So Warren Buffett doesn't do quarterly, he doesn't do quarterly conference calls with analysts. He sometimes will go on CNBC. He'll be quoted once in a while in the Wall Street Journal. He'll have his annual meeting, which is coming up. But this is really the time when he explains to his investors what's gone on right and wrong. One of the things I love about Warren Buffett and his approach is he takes the approach that whether you own one share of Berkshire Hathaway or you have all your money in Berkshire Hathaway, he treats it like we're investing all your money, all your investable worth. And so as a result, he takes the approach that even if you have 1% of your portfolio in Berkshire or 100%, I need to invest your money safely, no matter what. I'm not going to take risks. I'm not going to do dumb things. I'm going to have that margin of safety. It's a really interesting approach that he's taken. And your thoughts on the shareholder letter that he reported this year and what I just said?
Well, it was a little bit different this year than normal years. Maybe he's in a bad mood because Charlie died.
Yeah.
Right? There was a very nice eulogy to Charlie Munger. But I felt like he made a little bit more of an emphasis this year on some of the holdings that he had and around some of the thinking, right? There were a lot of people who noted that he didn't talk about Apple.
Yeah, I'm writing that down to mention, like, he didn't talk about Apple. How much does he have in Apple? $170 billion of it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, some people tried to interpret that as saying he doesn't have conviction in Apple, like maybe he's going to sell his stock. That's probably not how I would interpret it. I think Buffett doesn't have a history of just realizing capital gains for the sake of realizing gains. But I think it's certainly something that he did on purpose in the letter.
Yeah. So he left out, was there any mention whatsoever of Apple in the letter?
Yeah, there was.
Okay.
He said Apple was a major commitment.
Yeah.
So like, what else do you want him to say?
Okay.
I think what was a little bit more interesting was also, I think a lot of times people don't think of Berkshire as a group of actual businesses, mm-hmm. right? They think of it as Warren Buffett picking stocks,
yeah.
which is also true. Like he does buy stocks in the portfolio.
Over $300 billion of stocks in the portfolio. So there's a major commitment to stocks.
But then there's also actual businesses in there. There's a railroad business. There's like utilities, like these were two that were called out in the quarter.
Geico Insurance.
Yep, there was insurance, there's See's Candies.
Yep.
There's all sorts of stuff in there, right? And some of these have not done very well in recent years. And so that was something that he talked about in the letter as well.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the large person purchase of Apple, Buffett is not really into technology. He's completely missed those areas. If you look at the investments and businesses that he's made, there's really nothing, the actual business that you own, I don't think there's anything really technology related.
No.
No, it's more bet on the physical, tangible growth of the United States, moving stuff, providing electricity, oil and gas, building homes, stuff that goes in the houses, airplanes, those kind of things.
Yeah, gas stations.
Gas stations, yeah. So, I mean, people always talk about Buffett's, you know, core competency, circle of competency. He sticks to what he knows.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that's why in the letter, I think he spent a lot of time talking about the railroads.
Yeah.
BNSF, which has underperformed in recent years, right? And I think the other one that he pointed was not doing very well was the utility business.
All right. So let's talk about the underperforming assets. So the first one, Burlington Northern Santa Fe. That used to be a publicly traded company. I think Berkshire acquired it maybe a decade ago. The last year was a tough year for railroads, right? Just because of the normalization of moving stuff from the supply chain crisis that we had in 2021 and 2022. Our clients own shares. We own shares in Canadian Natural CNQ.
Canadian Natural Resources.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Canadian National Railway.
National Railway, yeah. So and that its results were not strong either, but it seems that Burlington BNSF did not have a good year in terms of profits and revenue growth.
Yeah, I think on the one side, as we knew from CN Rail, volumes were not great because, as you pointed out, of the pull forward and from supply chain disruptions in 2022. But at the other side is the cost side. Wages were still going up.
Yeah,
Buffett pointed out that fuel costs were high. People don't want to work for the railroads, so wages were going up. And you put all those things together and profitability was down quite a bit. And you add to the fact that they have to spend a lot on CapEx to maintain the railroads.
Correct. It's not a low capital business.
Yeah. And so that's where BNSF is today.
Did he give any hints about how things are going to turn around with BNSF? I'm going to screw that up. But if you look at the guidance from the Canadian railroads, for example, CP and CN, they're guiding for double-digit pretty much earnings growth this year, as well as strong recovery over the next 2 to 3 years. What's the issue at BNSF? And why can't Buffett turn that around in the short term?
Well, I think the Canadian railroads have a structural advantage over the American ones in that the American railroads often compete with trucks.
Yeah.
Because it's a fairly short distance in between cities and destinations. In Canada, you don't have that option just because everything is so far away from
the major cities. Okay. Yeah.
And so I would probably like characterize the Canadian railroads as more durable investments relative to the American ones. But I mean, like, that's more on the fringes. It's not like railroad demand is going to plummet by like 50% in the next 30 years or anything like that, right?
And this exposes a little bit of a problem with the way Berkshire owns companies, in my opinion, is when you're a publicly traded company, there's a lot of scrutiny, a lot of transparency, a lot of focus. You have a lot of different shareholders, stakeholders, with the goal of profit maximization, whereas Buffett may be a little more hands-off, decentralize, you know, go run your railroad, go do your best job. A lot of U.S. and Canadian railroads also follow this precision
railroading,
which is about cutting costs dramatically and keeping costs low. Whereas I don't think Buffett follows that with his railroad.
No, BNSF has said publicly that they don't believe in precision scheduled railroading.
Yeah. So as a result, you can't be surprised that once in a while, it may have tougher results. And a lot of the Canadian and U.S. railroads have been under, over the years, activist pressure. There's been underperformance. There's been the old boys club with a lot of them. Those things have been rectified as they've switched to precision railroading, which is essentially just cutting costs like crazy. And as a result, the performance of a lot of the railroads has been pretty good. So, I don't know, Buffett, I guess I read it that he expressed his disappointment with the management. And that was something that you rarely see Buffett call out in public.
Yes.
All right. On to the utility, which is another part of its business that has been doing lousy and the results were not good this year.
I think the utilities are in bigger trouble than the railroads mm-hmm. within the Berkshire portfolio. The issue with the utilities is that what Buffett is, the way that they historically work is that you spend money, like you build power lines or you spend some money to upgrade your utility and improve access.
Yeah.
And the state regulator approves a return on investment for you. The issue with this model is that when there's a natural disaster, such as the fires that have occurred in California, like you basically have to spend a lot of money to upgrade the network or just to get back to where you were, right? But then you're not going to earn any return on that because you're not improving anything. And you're just getting back to where you were.
Meantime, there's a legal case against Berkshire and other utilities that they caused some of those fires and there's judgment. And so not only do they have to pay, rebuild the whole system, pay a gigantic fine, and there's no return on that new investment that they make. So that doesn't sound like a good combination, Ernest.
No, and more importantly is that oftentimes the state regulators, like, they need to get reelected as well, right? So they have mandates that they don't want to raise rates, right? And so, like, it's a problem for the entire utility industry if that happens, because you need someone to pay for the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And if you're not getting a return on it, then you're not going to invest. So I think Buffett, pretty openly said that he regrets his investment in some of these utilities and doesn't want to keep pouring good money after bad.
So, I mean, that's at least that's the recognition that maybe stop the investments and see if things can be rectified that way by regulators, maybe increasing returns or, but I think Buffett has a history, like everybody, of maybe staying in some things for too long, but he also has a good history of cutting his losses when need be. And especially he talks all about the fact that he's managing your entire money. And so he doesn't like to have losses in his portfolio either. Well, so we'll see what happens.
But, but the one thing I will say is that, you know, like, the railroads and the utilities are big portions of Berkshire, but nobody is buying Berkshire stock because they have a they believe in the future of BNSF or Berkshire Hathaway Energy.
Right? Exactly.
What they're investing in is the ability of Warren Buffett to deploy capital intelligently, make more acquisitions, you know, buy Apple stock when it's cheap and compound value like that over time. So
that's right. And there's a lot of things. I mean, we did say some negative things, but there's more good things working in Berkshire than not working. And possibly some of these things can be turned around and get the Berkshire machine going again. I mean, no one's going to cry for Berkshire stockholders. I think the stock did better than the S&P 500 in 2023, had a nice start to 2024, I believe. So, you know, Buffett still knows what he's doing and he still got it.
And he pointed out something that I think is really important for investors to remember, which is that if you have one big winner, it can take care of a lot of losers, right? So in this case, he made one Apple investment. And that's covered over whatever losses he's had at Berkshire Hathaway Energy many times over, just because of the compounding nature of great investments, right? And that's, I think that speaks to the fact that if you have a proverbial flower, you shouldn't cut it, right? Like, because it will over time become a larger and larger portion of your portfolio.
You just water it, feed it, sing to it, and leave it be. So Berkshire, been a tough, you know, he's pointed out some of the negative things, of course, but on the positive side, before we finish that discussion, is he's got a lot of cash, getting a lot of interest income. Interest rates doesn't look like they're going to get cut as fast as one had thought at the beginning of the year. $160+ billion earning 5% interest, and that cash pile is growing. And even though some of the divisions did not have as robust results as prior years, that it's a cash compounding machine, Berkshire Hathaway.
And still managed by Buffett,
right?
Like, the greatest investor of all time.
Sounds good. So switching gears quickly to talk about the Canadian banks. They all reported earnings the last week. Mixed results, but probably not as bad as feared in terms of loan loss provisions, as well as the Canadian consumer not really yet feeling the impacts as much as maybe the market was worried about in terms of the rising interest rates and inflation. The housing market's still been very strong. A lot of Canadian banks, as you know, have moved assets to the United States, and the United States is doing okay. Our favorite Canadian bank, Ernest, is National Bank, which hit an all-time high. I mean, you would have told me that we're worried about rising rates and we're worried about a mortgage crisis and we're worried about the Canadian consumer in the next couple of years. And here's, you know, a few Canadian banks hitting all-time highs. What's going on?
National is a bit different from the other banks because they focus primarily on Quebec, which is... No, like, Canada is a big place. Quebec's not Ontario. It's not BC. They have better economic fundamentals than the rest of the country. And they have... the housing is certainly much more reasonably valued there. Consumer debt is much lower as a percentage of income. think that people are generally a little more conservative for whatever reason. So like you just have a little bit less risk to the economy in Quebec. And like if you're a bank, like that's what you should worry about.
And
they have a super strong balance sheet. Like they expect they're going to raise their dividend next year, which is not something that every bank can say.
Yeah.
And so I think they're well positioned.
So all the bank CEOs did sound a warning, of course, of the upcoming impact to consumers as interest rates go up, as people's fixed mortgages start to come due and have to be reinvested or refinanced at higher interest rates. As you know, in Canada, most people have 5-year fixed mortgages. Many people may have gotten those mortgages in 2019, 2020, 2021, when interest rates were a lot lower than they are today. Today, the Bank of Canada announced another, keeping interest rates flat, said they possibly could raise rates, which is something you don't want to hear, of course. The U.S.'s economy is doing strong as well, so probably no significant rate cuts in the next few months. And so banks are worried about that. But on the other hand, loan losses are not going up dramatically. The Canadian economy is doing okay. The U.S. economy is doing better. So I guess the big fears about any short-term dips in the Canadian economy or the banks is probably delayed for now.
Yeah, there was a scary headline from Equifax.
Okay.
That mortgage delinquencies were up 54% in the last quarter, right? Which sounds really scary until you consider that it went from 0.09% to 0.14%, right? Which is still
next to nothing.
Obviously tiny.
Yeah.
Right.
And how does that compare, of course, to history? What's more important is...
Right.
Yeah.
It's still historically low, even relative to 2020.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Canadians really can't default on their houses, right?
You can.
Yeah.
You can default, but you still have to pay it.
Yeah. So you can't walk away from your house versus where the U.S. where people could just walk away from their houses with no liability to them.
Yeah. I think big picture on the Canadian banks, not seeing material loan losses or evidence of impairments, but certainly noting that consumer spending is declining because of higher interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy to have conviction on the Canadian banks right now, but I guess that's what happens when you have some headwinds in front of you. It hasn't been easy to have conviction on the Canadian banks for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Whether it was COVID, whether it was worries about falling into a recession, some of those worries never came true. The Canadian banks seem to have skated away from these problems very easily. And their balance sheets are still, I mean, their regulatory capital seems strong, but bad stuff can happen.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's a wishy-washy kind of answer on the banks, but you know, our clients can see from our exposure to the Canadian banks that we like National Bank, that's kind of it. So on to our feature discussion, which is Canadian Natural Resources, CNQ. Reported strong earnings, finally reached their debt target, which means as of now, the company is going to start to deliver all the free cash flow that it earns back to shareholders. So it maintains a base dividend, which it has grown for 24 years in a row. Is that right? 23, 24 years?
Yeah, something like that.
So the base dividend. And then after the base dividend, whatever's left over after capital expenditures or maybe if it makes an acquisition, whatever's left over is either going to come back to shareholders again as more dividend increases or share buybacks. Ernest, a lot of our clients can understand a dividend. They can see a dividend, but what is a share buyback? A quick explainer of a share buyback and how that works.
So a share buyback is simply when a company goes into the public markets, like you or me, and they buy stock. They buy stock of themselves, right? Oftentimes when, I think in Canada, when they buy back a stock, it just goes away.
Yeah.
It's canceled.
Canceled.
And so the result is that there's less shares outstanding and the price will go up because there's less shares. So that's simply what a buyback is. It's another way of returning cash to shareholders, like dividends. And it's often viewed as more flexible and more tax efficient than dividends.
Correct. Okay. So, and if a company is like Canadian Natural Resources, oil prices have been stable. They don't need to go out and spend more money to expand the oil sands. It's gushing all this free cash flow. Then it has to decide after the base dividend if the stock price maybe is under pressure for whatever reason, or oil stocks haven't done well, maybe it's a smart time to buy back stock. Or maybe it's like, well, let's just give more back to the shareholders at this time. I mean, it's a good problem to have. And I think over the long term, the management has been very good allocators of capital.
Right. I think they can probably do about, I don't know, I think it's probably stocks probably trading at about 10% free cash flow yield today. Dividends yielding 4.5%. And the management said on the earnings call that they still like the value of the stock here. Mm-hmm. They think that buybacks are an attractive use of cash. And you can easily see 4-5% share count reduction through buybacks.
And that starts to add up meaningfully over time.
Yep.
Right? So if there's 100 shares outstanding today and 10 years from now, that drops to, I don't know, 60 shares outstanding, the stock price is going to go up, all things being equal.
Yeah. And I think there's a decent case to be made that the stock price is still cheap.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
So every year, oil companies have to do an estimate of what their reserves are worth. Mm-hmm. And so in the most recent quarter, Canadian Natural said that they think that their proved and developing reserves, so assets that are already producing oil,
yeah,
it's worth about $100 a share,
okay,
Canadian. And that's where the share price is today, 97, right? Yep. So what that means is that you're just buying their producing assets today with no consideration. You're not paying anything extra for their non-developed resources or their what we call probable resources, which are resources that they think are there but not like geologically proven to be extractable. So a lot of upside there.
And in the past, of course, Canadian Natural Resources has increased its reserve life by getting these non-developed and unproven resources proven.
Yes.
And so they have a very good track record of delivering stuff that is not yet, you know, guaranteed to become guaranteed reserve life, and so to speak.
No, and I think that's really the beauty of Canadian Natural's business model, mm-hmm, which is that they have these super long life assets. They have massive reserves. I think it's $14 billion of barrels of oil,
yeah,
which is, I think, by itself would be the 15th largest country in the world.
Wow. So they say they have, right now, if they never drilled for more oil or however you get to find more oil sands, they have 32 years of reserve life at current production levels.
Exactly.
So which they
yes.
You know, it's quite a long time.
Right. And the reason that this matters is because most oil companies, like they drill oil, like the oil well starts to decline, mm-hmm, and then you have to go out and find more oil, right? So that's why they trade at low multiples historically, because it's not a recurring revenue.
Yeah.
Like you have to go out and your first of all, your well gets less productive. So your business is naturally declining, and then you have to spend money to go out and find more oil. And that's it's really expensive. It's hard to find oil. It's hard to make reserves.
It's very hard, yeah.
So Canadian Natural doesn't have to do any of that. They already have the oil there. And more importantly is that it doesn't decline, right? The oil sands, by their nature, you just go in and you kind of dig it out, right? So next year's production, like, is not lower than what it was this year.
In fact, it should increase because yes, they are very good at converting these non-developed to producing assets. And there's a good chance that over the next few years, the reserve life at 32 years will still be 32 years.
Yes.
So if you're CNQ management, Canadian Natural Resources Management, you have good certainty that that's the case. And if oil prices, who knows what oil prices are going to do, but if oil prices do tick up from here, that NAV, that $100 a share that you think it's worth, is now worth still more than $100. And in the meantime, you've sent more money back to shareholders in dividends and share buybacks.
I think one other factor that I would mention for Canadian natural resources is that Canadian oil prices are likely to do a bit better than what the oil headlines that you see, right? In Canada, for the last, since 2016, essentially, oil prices have been under pressure because of lack of pipeline access. Historically, we've talked about this in another podcast before, called "Wait a Minute, You Bought an Oil Stock?"
Yeah,
I think this was about a year ago.
Yeah,
but to make a long story short, historically, Canada exported all their oil to the U.S. The U.S. developed oil through shale fracking, and they didn't need Canadian oil. Canada had no ability to move their oil to other markets because Alberta's, you know, in the middle of
nowhere,
is not connected to an ocean. Mm-hmm. But this is about to change because the TMX pipeline is
almost done.
It's finished.
It's finished.
It is finished.
Yeah, it's finished now. Okay.
I think it's finished. It's not shipping yet, yeah, but it's finished. Okay. So
kind of like the Eglinton Crosstown in Toronto. It's finished, but not shipping people yet. Okay.
And so the TMX expansion triples the amount of oil that can be shipped, crude, that can be shipped for export on the Pacific in the Pacific Ocean. What this will likely do is that it will narrow the discount that Canadian oil is trading at relative to other international benchmarks.
That's right. So when you see oil trading at $80 as it is today, CNQ isn't actually getting $80 per barrel that it's selling, right? On some of its oil it is, but not exclusively.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think what a lot of industry observers are expecting is that not only will the heavy oil discount narrow, but that the synthetic crude oil, the high quality product that CNQ is producing from their oil sands, mm-hmm. it will also regain its premium that it historically has achieved.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of good tailwinds in terms of pricing for CNQ as well.
Excellent. And so the thought experiment that you and I have talked about, of course, is this is a company that has 30 plus year reserve life of oil. Increasing production. Everybody says it is expensive compared to other oil companies, which is true, but this is not an oil company. This is now a royalty company in some sense. And does it deserve to be valued as a royalty business instead of a pure oil and gas producer, which they're always traded low multiples because it's harder to get the oil out and it's boom bust. Could the mindset change on Canadian Natural Resources, and could the valuation, even though the stock has done incredible and it's now one of the largest market cap companies in Canada, is there a lot more room to go as a result?
Well, I think that's the thing, especially in Canada, is that so many of the analysts that are focused on the energy sector are energy analysts. Like they're very sector focused on energy. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that they're looking at is energy stocks, maybe some other commodities,
sure.
but by and large focused on energy, right? So when they see Canadian Natural trading at 11 times earnings, compare that to Suncor or some other junior oil and gas company that trades at like 5, 6, 7 times, mm-hmm. they say, yeah, CNQ is expensive,
yeah,
right? And yeah, it's more expensive than other oil companies.
100%.
But if you're looking at this from a generalist lens, so relative to all other companies, right? You have a company that basically can maintain production for 32 years, mm-hmm. right? You have this world-class management team at controlling costs and doing acquisitions at the right time and kind of doing the right thing at the right time, right? And just simply gushing free cash flow, I think there's a case to be made that it should trade at a much higher multiple, mm-hmm. right? Like, and just as an example, Franco-Nevada, like it's a gold royalty company. They trade at 30 times earnings, mm-hmm. right? I'm not saying that CNQ should get that multiple,
yeah.
but like it's kind of arbitrary to say that, oh, 11 times earnings is too high just because it's an oil company, and kind of ignoring the economic reality of the business.
Yeah.
Right.
Very interesting. So we'll see what happens there. Anything else you want to add on Canadian Natural Resources?
Yeah, I think one last thing I would point out is that their budget was pretty interesting, and they are focused more on developing their heavy oil bitumen reserves, which is not surprising considering the fact that the TMX pipeline is focused on heavy oil, yeah. And that's where you see the most upside in the near term. So that's one last thing I would point out.
Very good. So we'll see what happens with CNQ in the next little while, but we're very excited to continue to remain shareholders of the company. So that's all we got for you this week. We'll see you back here real soon. Thank you very much.
Bye.
This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.